In Session with Dr. Fadid Holakwi.
Good afternoon. Welcome to In Session. I'm your host, Dr. Fadid Holakwi, and I'll be with you for the next 2 hours here on Radio Hamra. Studio number to call in, 310-441-0555. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram or like my page on Facebook to get updates on the show or suggest topics or books for the program. And the shows are uploaded at the end of each week to my SoundCloud page and podcasts on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Again, our studio number, 310-441-0555. Today I'm joined by some very wonderful guests from UCLA who are here to promote an event that I'm very happy to be a part of next week, which is a mental health seminar Thursday, April 18th at 5 p.m. on the UCLA campus in the Neuroscience Research Building. I will be posting the details on my social media soon, so you can check that out. But joining me today are members from two organizations, from Sigma Pi Sigma Psi, which is an Iranian sorority. We have Kimia and Hannah. And from Alpha Gamma Alpha, an Armenian sorority at UCLA, we have Sarah and Monica. Thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
So, as I mentioned, you have planned this wonderful event next week on Thursday, April 18th on the UCLA campus. But maybe first, before we get into that event, you could let me and the listeners know more about your organizations. Since I had mentioned it first, we'll start with Sigma Pi, Sigma Psi. Either Kimi or Hannah, if you want to tell us a bit about your organization on the UCLA campus.
Yeah, so Sigma Pi Sigma Psi, also known as PISCO, which stands for the Persian Society of Community Outreach. It was founded in 2009, and then after we got our Greek letters a few years later. It's the one and only Persian sorority right now in the world, and we are a community service organization focusing mainly on upholding the cultural values of Iranian American women, and our members engage in a bunch of events that keep the Persian culture alive and defy many negative stereotypes that are out there about Persian women.
Wonderful. That's great. When I was there, I know there's a few Iranian groups. This one I didn't know about, actually, Sigma Pi, Sigma Psi. I knew about ISG, yeah. The Iranian student group. I got to do Baba Karam in the cultural show back in 2005. But this is a very different type of event I'll be doing next week. And also Alpha Gamma Alpha. We have Sarah and Monica. Either of you could tell us a bit about your organization.
Oh, hi, everyone. My name is Monica. I'm part of Alpha Gamma Alpha, and I'm the president right now. And we're an Armenian culture sorority here, like at UCLA. We were the founders, but there are many chapters across California, like in UC Irvine, Riverside, CSUN, UC San Diego. And we are currently trying to establish a new chapter in Berkeley. AG has basically united Armenian women, and it's an organization that's dedicated to cultural and philanthropic endeavors that basically we're trying to advance the Armenian cause and raise awareness, not just on our campus, but in our local community. And we are focused on our philanthropic work, which we will discuss later on.
Wonderful. Yes, that's great. I think it's so wonderful that these two organizations, you're out there, you're trying to, it's for the Iranian and Armenian students, but now you're even collaborating together, working on this project or this event that's happening next week. I think that's great because, of course, our communities overlap in so many ways, but also we just need to be there for one another when we're facing struggles or injustices around the world. We don't need, or we'd like, not just the people who are suffering, sometimes they can't even talk, we need to be a voice for them, but especially communities coming together can be wonderful to speak up for one another and make that type of an impact. Maybe we could talk a bit about the event. We'll probably jump around a bit, talk about different things. So any of you could take this, yeah, tell us about the event, what was the motivation behind it, and then even how the two groups came together to plan this event. I don't know, Hannah, if you're ready for that one, to put you on the spot.
especially with everything going on in both Iran and Armenia, it's taken a big toll on a lot of our people. And, you know, Sarah says this a lot, Iran and Armenia share borders. You know, we share a lot of cultural similarities as well. And so especially with everything going on, it's good to raise awareness on that. Mm-hmm. And with everything going on, it's definitely taken an impact on a lot of our people here in America as well. And so I know a lot of us are very big on activism and, you know, trying to protest protest and help our people in those countries, but how are we supposed to help them if we can't help ourselves first and have a good mental space? So basically the mission behind this panel is to be able to kind of raise awareness on our mental health while also emphasizing the events that are going on in both our countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. Mental health, that is an issue that of course affects all humans, but we see different cultural factors that make it, that increase or, you know, introduce challenges to individuals from various cultures. And I think in the Iranian and the Armenian cultures, we see, unfortunately, a lot of negative stereotypes, stigmatization about mental health issues or about seeking out mental health services of any kind is seen as a negative. I think that is changing slightly, but still we have a lot of work to do. So I think it's wonderful to have events like this where the focus is mental health awareness. But I think you brought up a great point that also what's going on around the world is going to impact us. And this is something that's come up a lot on my own show of how can we support those, you know, talk about these issues that are going around the world and make sure we're doing our part, our responsibility. But of course, it also takes a toll on our own mental health. And it's this complex dilemma that we all have to figure out. How can I help and be of service, but also how can I make sure I'm okay? Definitely. At the same time. So I think it's great that this event is in a way bringing about these two interconnected issues. I don't know, Sarah, if you had something to add to that about the event or anything.
Hi, I'm Sarah Shabazian. I'm the philanthropy chair of Alpha Gamma Alpha. So we are excited to announce our upcoming mental health seminar featuring a panel of 7 mental health specialists of Armenian and Iranian descent. This event addresses the pressing issue of the loss of Artsakh and the Women Life Freedom Movement and how our communities can overcome these challenges through mental health support and positive activism. So the way we came up with this idea was so simple yet incredibly effective. I mean, me and Kimia, we always study in the same library and we just came up with the idea of like, how can we bring both communities together but address these pressing topics and support one another? So it was just it takes a lot of work, and we've been working weeks and months on setting this organization and this panel up, and we're just so incredibly privileged to be hosting such an event and having such incredible guest speakers such as you, Dr. Holakwi.
Oh, well, I'm quite honored. There's something in my throat. I'm a little emotional, but I'm also kind of had something in my throat. But I am honored to be there. And I think it's wonderful that you've put the work in. You know, you're saying you're privileged, but it's been, you have put a lot of work to make this happen and to make this event happen, and we're looking forward to it. Maybe we could talk a bit about that. How can people attend if they're in the LA area?
Yeah, so it's free for all students. Undergrad and grad students can come for free. You just have to show student ID. It doesn't have to be UCLA. It could be any kind of university in the area, CSUN, even community college students like Pierce College, Glendale Community College. But for adults and non-students, it's an $8 entry fee, but all those profits will be going to donations for a good cause. Sarah, there's one organization they have in mind that they'll be donating to. But yeah, we'll also be selling shirinis or desserts there too. And all profits are going to be going to a nonprofit that supports mental health issues.
Wonderful. That's great. Sarah, can you tell us about the organization you're raising funds for?
So one organization that AGA wants to donate to is Frontline Therapists. It's an incredible org. We've been following them for many years now. And they really do focus on providing free mental health resources for the soldiers who have served in the Artsakh War, as well as the displaced families that have been forced out of their a home. And these services provide like therapy and just psychiatric psychology help for these individuals who have suffered trauma.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that's great. And we're very happy that you're doing that. And for anyone who comes out, they'll be supporting that organization. And as Kimia mentioned, 5 p.m. on Thursday. And if you've been to UCLA campus, you know it's not so easy to get around, or take some time. So if the event starts at 5, I really encourage you to try to get there 4-ish, you know, 4, 4:30 at the latest, because you have to park and then walk. So I really, you know, us Middle Easterners, we're good at being late places. I hope we can go against that stereotype and show up on time. So I'd love to see so many people there and in attendance to be there. And about the event itself, as you mentioned, there's several speakers. So what's the format of the event going to be like? Anyone could take that.
So one of the formats that we're trying to do is we are going to start on time, as you said,
yes.
Because we are we booked the room, so we have to follow strict time. It's going to be from 5 to 7, and if it is end up going a little over, we obviously will allow that. So the first hour, we're going to have a few of the guest speakers first introduce themselves and their name, their career, because not everyone is a psychiatrist. Some of them might be psychologists, mm-hmm. Or working in other areas of mental health, like therapists. So they're first going to introduce themselves, and then we're going to do a little intermission. And then after the intermission, we're going to have the other half introduce themselves as well. And then we're going to have a Q&A session at the end. So whatever questions that people have, please ask. It could be about anything. It doesn't have to be about even the communities or mental health. If you're pre-med and want to ask on how they like got to that career and what they did, like just any questions that you might have. And then we're just going to like close it up, and basically that's it. And we're gonna have lots of food for people as well.
That's great too. Yeah. So there'll be some. Yeah, you said introduction. I think short talks from what I understood, and then question and answers where people can ask questions that, as you said, they don't have to be specifically related to what was brought up, but there will be definitely themes around mental health and also the injustices that our communities have faced and how we've been trying to be supporting the individuals going through those injustices. And if any of you want to talk about your organizations and what else they have going on, you know, I think it'd be great to know more about what you do outside of just this event. You mentioned philanthropy and other things that you're doing.
No, yeah. So from Sigma Pi Sigma Psi or PISCO's side, we do a lot of cultural promotion events. We volunteer with Fire Hang Foundation twice every year. That big Noros event you see every year,
yeah.
And then their gala. We were always volunteering for them. And then also, we've grown a lot in the past 3 years. We straight out of COVID, we only had 4 members, which was really scary. But right after that, now we're standing really strong with 35 women. It kind of just shows that Persian woman, we can get together and we are strong together and we support each other really well. We have very successful alumni in medical school right now, residency, lawyers, psychiatrists, everything you can name. And it just shows that Persian women, we defy those stereotypes of always fighting, can't get along. We're always strong together and we're going to stand strong together. And that's kind of what you're seeing right now in the world right now with the Woman Life Freedom Movement.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, as we're seeing how powerful Iranian women are and how they've been at the front lines of what's been happening there. So it's wonderful that you here are also carrying that forward and trying to unite and do good in the world. Monica, Sarah, could you tell us a bit more about what you're doing at your organization?
Yeah, so earlier in the fall quarter, we had a campaign, per se, where at the peak of the Artsakh war, we UCLA students, like, we wanted to not only raise awareness of what was going on during the war, but we also wanted to raise a substantial amount of money to provide humanitarian aid for the displaced families specifically. So in AGA, we had a very large raffle where we involved over 20 Armenian local businesses in LA, outside of LA, in Canada, where we asked these businesses to donate either a good or service, where we would raffle off and essentially donate all the money that we make at this raffle. At the end of the raffle, we raised roughly $12,000, which is so exciting, and it was just surreal. And at the end, we donated the money to Hike for Our Heroes organization, which directly aids the displaced families in terms of providing medical care, housing, and just basic necessities to make sure that these families can make it safe across the border and into Armenia. I believe Monica, she calculated the amount of money we've raised this year, and it's truly incredible.
Yeah, so I had to calculate the amount of work that we had done for the past year, and so far for just fall and winter quarter, we have raised $16,000 that have
amazing.
All been thank you that have all been donated to Armenia through different organizations. and hopefully we can raise more before we graduate.
Yeah.
But just in general, besides our philanthropic work, the past 4 years that I've been in AGA, like, I have truly seen how much this organization has grown. Just like what Kimia said about Pisco, the amount of people in our organization has grown. There's more awareness, more people know about the organization as well, where before it was like, oh, just 10 girls in a sorority, but it's more than that. It's a group of women who get together to all for one specific cause, and like, what can we do to raise money, raise awareness, but also learn more about our culture, because we do always talk about what's going on in our country, like during our meetings as well. So it's more than just a group of girls in like a sorority.
That's wonderful. That's great. Yep, I think everyone listening will be very proud of all of you, and of course those of the groups that aren't here, the organizations that aren't here. But what I was thinking is maybe we could talk a bit more after break, because this whole event being about mental health, and I know you represent your organizations, but you're of course members of the communities as well, and you see what it's like to be Armenian, be Iranian, and how mental health is talked about or not talked about, and how that impacts us. So I would like to hear from all of you. We could maybe have a bit of a discussion after the break, if that's okay with you. Yeah? Okay. So again, I'm joined today by Kimia and Hannah from Sigma Pi, Sigma Psi, and Sarah and Monica from Alpha Gamma Alpha. We'll talk some more after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Again, I'm joined by members of Sigma Pi Sigma Psi and Alpha Gamma Alpha, who have together organized an event next Thursday, April 18th at UCLA, about mental health, and very happy to have them on. And as I mentioned before the break, I wanted to talk a bit from the four of you. Of course, you're officers of these wonderful organizations at UCLA, but you're also human beings and individuals of the community, and so you have your own experiences about mental health and culture and all of those things and how they interact. So I'd be happy to hear from you and just get some thoughts on your own experiences or what you've seen in our communities, because I definitely see a lot of stigma attached to mental illness and seeking out mental health services, which I think sadly harms so many people. So I'd be happy to hear from any of you about what you see and have experienced yourself, and you could take it away.
So one thing that I have noticed specifically in the Armenian community is where mental health isn't really prioritized and psychiatric care is not really considered medicine. So this is one thing that we are really trying to combat, because if as a nation we cannot prioritize our mental health, how are we supposed to grow and become better individuals? Mm-hmm. So specifically after the loss of Artsakh, I've noticed that in the Armenian community there's a sense of hopelessness. Like how can we as Armenians move on from this? What can we do to take initiative, be proactive, and just better our country, better our nation? But people are stuck in a hole like that they cannot get out of. And with this mental health awareness panel, we just want to address these issues and utilize these incredible minds that are going to be coming, and hear what they have to say as to how the Armenian and Iranian communities can move on from these like traumatic situations.
Yeah, beautifully said. I think, and even you said move on. And what's tough is that what we're talking about, like the Woman Life Freedom and what you were discussing, these are not things that just end or haven't ended yet. We're still in them. And so moving on can be so tough because we're still in it. So it's how do we move forward with carrying this extra burden of the stress and staying engaged, staying involved. It's something I've discussed a lot when the Woman Life Freedom movement started. I didn't know, but I thought likely it's going to take a long time. I know if people were very hopeful and okay, it's going to change. Everything's going to be, you know, the regime's going to come down in a week, 2 weeks, a month. And of course, that didn't happen. And so I knew that burnout was very possible and very likely, because you want to help, you want to change, you're so sad, we're seeing all these videos and pictures and it's breaking our hearts, and we're, you know, it takes a toll on us, and it makes it easier to give up, to lose hope, as you were saying. You've seen many Armenians losing hope, and it's tough at times to not lose hope, but I think, you know, you're talking about coming together can help. It doesn't make it easy, can make it less hard, won't make it easy in any way, but can make it easier in a way. So I think that's really nice that you're, you know, you've noticed that and you want to contribute to that, that we're focusing on how we're doing, and you talk about mental health. And I think both of our communities are, you know, really the, in general humans, but especially Middle Eastern communities, you see a lot of physical pain being real and mental pain not being real, or being something that's like, quote unquote, in your head, or you should just get over. And it's very sad because it is a real part of the human experience and just as real as physical pain, but it's not given the same attention, care, and love as mental and emotional pain, unfortunately. So, Kimi, I don't know if you had any thoughts. It seemed like you wanted to chime in there.
No, yeah, definitely a lot what Sarah said resonates with our side as well, and a lot of girls in our sorority as well. I actually wasn't really taking care of my mental health at the beginning of my university experience. Towards the end of it, I had a lot going on, and testing anxiety got to me really easily. It's really common for UCLA students with mm-hmm. that high pressure sure. environment they're in to kind of just forget about taking care of themselves. But a lot of girls in the sorority actually recommended that I take care of my mental health more, and it's improved dramatically just in the past 6 months. I used to go in with a lot of anxiety into things, and now I can walk into anything a lot more calmly, and that just really shows how much taking care of your mental health can help in any other aspect, not just quote unquote your happiness, but it can help in your work, it can help in your social life, in any other aspect. Taking care of your mental health takes care of a lot of other things, and I'm really happy girls in my sorority really pushed me to do that.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, it's a part of taking care of ourselves. It's, you know, we sometimes separate these things so much, and sometimes we need to talk about them, but our mental health and physical health, it's really part of a whole, just taking care of ourselves. And so if we're not okay, obviously we can't do well in other aspects of life. But I think I'm sure all four of you are high achievers. You're at UCLA. To get into UCLA is difficult, and to stay there and be competitive is difficult. So often individuals who are high achieving feel like they should be able to handle everything and nothing should get to them, and they shouldn't need more help, or they should be able to figure it out on their own. Or you also see things where pluralistic ignorance. So, well, it looks like everyone else is handling it okay, so if I'm stressed, there must be something wrong with me, and I'm the only one, where it turns out actually everyone's struggling. And the more we talk about it, makes it more okay to not be okay and to be a human being and go through what we all go through. So I think it's great, another reason to have events like this where we just make it more okay to talk about mental health issues, because so everyone's carrying pain, everyone's carrying something, but we often don't think it's okay to share it.
No, definitely. Having this kind of event with girls coming together, being a woman going, like all four of us, we want to apply to medical school, going to that field as a woman can be very difficult. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of small hoops here and there that you didn't even realize existed. And noticing that there's all these people in both our communities who are professionals in mental health will really kind of persuade more people to take care of it and realize, hey, like, this is an issue everyone experiences. Mm. You don't have to be crazy to seek mental health resources. I even was convinced by my own primary care physician to seek to talk to someone, because herself said, I have my own therapist just because it's a very tough career and I need someone to kind of help me go through it. So a lot of people should, everyone should take care of their mental health. You don't have to be crazy to go seek a therapist. Everyone is going through something, and if you take care of it, it'll make everything easier.
Absolutely,
Bouncing back on what Kimia said, there definitely is a big cultural stigma in both our communities, and I think across all Middle Eastern communities, about seeking help and seeing a therapist. Mm-hmm. When I first started seeing my therapist, I was a little embarrassed. I was kind of ashamed. Like, I feel like, do I need help? I don't want people seeing I'm weak like that. And it's definitely not something traditional that I've seen in my culture. But like you said, mental pain is, you know, as prevalent as physical pain. And just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. And so it's so important to emphasize our mental health and see a professional if we need to talk to some people. I think everyone can benefit from it, no matter how healthy they think that they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you both sharing, you know, going to therapists yourself. I've gone many years to therapy, and you know, think it's a wonderful thing to go through and to experience. And I do encourage everyone to do it, because I think it's not something for, like, if you're crazy or you're weak at all. It's just something that helps you take care of your health. Just like if you saw someone get a trainer to work out, you wouldn't think, oh, there's something wrong with them. You're thinking, oh, they're really prioritizing their physical health and they want to take care of themselves. Similarly, you see a therapist, it's just to improve and continue to, you know, make yourself feel better in that aspect of life. So I think you're totally right. And you know, Kimia, you spoke about all of you being pre-med, wanting to go into the medical field. And again, this is me probably mansplaining, but I wanted to share a story of my cousin's wife. That both, they're both physicians, and but she shared with me that she's been in meetings with other, you know, a group of doctors, and they'll, you know, call everyone doctor, and they'll address her by her first name, like almost like not giving her that same status in a way. So it's these, like, you know, and I know it's this like cliche term of microaggressions, but really it does exist, where there's ways that are sometimes subtle, but sometimes of course very overt, but also these subtle ways where there are challenges, like you're saying, hoops that you might not even imagine, or hoops that others might not have to go through. Being a woman, I'm sure also being a Middle Eastern woman could add extra challenges as well.
No, definitely. All 4 years at UCLA, there's been little hoops here and there that have happened. That story where you're talking about your relative, even when I worked as a medical assistant, people would always refer to me as the nurse. I was not a certified nurse at all.
Yeah.
Kudos to them, but I was not a certified nurse at all. But if the doctor came in, who at that point was a male, immediately labeled them as a doctor. So like being aware that those hoops do exist, definitely helps. When I came into UCLA, I wasn't really aware of that many hoops that can happen going into this field as a woman, as a young woman, and as a Middle Eastern woman. But honestly, my sorority really helped me realize that those hoops do exist, and kind of having that support system of Persian girls really supported me. And it wasn't only just the cultural aspect, but it was kind of a group of Persian girls who grew up in California, because it's another whole experience. Kind of like in my high school, I was one of only 5 Persian people in the whole high school of 2,000 students. Wow. Like, that was a whole experience for me. And Hannah kind of had the same experience herself. Mm-hmm. So when I came to UCLA and met a bunch of people who were in that same boat as me, it really helped me combat a lot of things I didn't expect to happen to me going to UCLA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and I thank you for what you shared. But Monica, Sarah, either of you also, what you've experienced, or, you know, could be at the mental health side, or both wanting to go to medicine and what that's like as women in your community, anything related to those topics?
Just to add on for, like, the stigma behind mental health in our communities, I have so seen that, like, throughout my entire life, because I think most people, especially in the older generations, might see this as, like, not real help or just fake medicine, but that is so not the case. Especially like me right now, I'm majoring in psychobiology at UCLA, and I'm currently in a class that's basically about mind and body interactions, and basically just stress and how stress is like related to the immune system. And next week we're going to be talking about how this affects our cardiovascular health. So stress itself can cause so many other health issues later on in your life that you might not realize it now, but maybe like 10 or 20, 30 years down the line, you might like notice all these issues. So this is very important to take care of yourself. And you don't need to see a serious weakness to go talk to a therapist. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes people just need someone to talk to, and there's nothing wrong with that. And it's very important to take care of yourself.
Sure.
But also to add on to the, like, how we're all women in medicine, which is like so awesome. But in our communities, I think one of the biggest, I guess, like, hoops that we have to jump is, like, so many people might say, oh, like, you're gonna be in school until like you're 30. Like, what are you going to do? Like, all of this other, especially in our Middle Eastern culture. But I think it's very important to encourage other, I guess, younger girls to like not give up, and like you have to surround yourself with like-minded people who have similar goals, and just not listen to all of this like hate, I would call it, because it might not be for other people, but if that's what you want, then you should just stick through it, even if it takes like a decade to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. That's I'm sure that there's lots of different challenges. That could be another one about the lifestyle, or how it's going to affect you, and, you know, of course, assumptions, especially from previous generations, but they still exist, is that a woman's role might be more limited than what it actually is, and all 4 of you are a testament to that. So I appreciate you sharing those parts of your experience. And I did want to hear, actually, you know, I'm looking at the time, we're at another commercial break, but I'm happy to continue discussion, because I'm really enjoying hearing from all of you. And even, I think, you know, Sarah and Monica, from the, you know, the Armenian community, I think our communities are very similar, and even, I don't want to differentiate them so much, but there are going to be nuances. So I'd want to hear even from both of you more about mental health, even when it comes to things like gender roles. And I thought that's maybe a topic we're kind of getting into, talking about women in medicine and women in general and what you've experienced. So I think those are some themes we might be able to explore in the next segment. Again, the event that we have been talking about is next week, Thursday, April 18th on the UCLA campus starting at 5 p.m. I'm joined today by Sarah, Monica, Hannah, and Kimia from Sigma Pi, Sigma Psi. We have Kimia and Hannah, and from Alpha Gamma Alpha, we have Sarah and Monica. Let's go to another commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Again, I'm joined by Hannah, Kimia, Monica, Sarah, and we're talking about, now we've moved on into even gender roles, mental health, all sorts of different issues in the Iranian and Armenian communities. And Sarah, during the break, you said you wanted to share a story of an experience you had in Armenia.
Yeah, so previously we were talking about women in medicine, and it truly is incredible that all of us, we're the generation that's really changing the idea of gender role, specifically in both communities. We're seeing more women pursuing fields of medicine, becoming physicians, lawyers, and really changing these roles, which is incredible, and I'm so blessed to be a part of this generation. One thing that we did mention during the break was just like a medical mission that I pulled to Armenia with an organization called Medics in Armenia. I'm the co-president of that org at UCLA, where we pull a summer trip to Armenia, and we have American students shadowing physicians in the three major hospitals in Armenia. And one common pattern that you do see in Armenia is almost all the physicians are men, and all the nurses are women. So specifically when we were out there shadowing, the physicians thought that we were nurses and really did not consider us like as pre-meds or potential medical students. So that was one thing that we were trying to combat. But especially in these ORs, when you're shadowing these doctors in the middle of a surgery, like everything is so chaotic, and especially when interacting with these surgeons and saying that, oh, you want to, that one day I want to be a doctor just like you, how I look up to you, I want to be a physician and be a surgeon one day, they just kind of look in your face and see like, you don't really belong here. And I had this one experience personally with an anesthesiologist. He truly was a brilliant man, and we ended up being friends at the end, and he does keep in touch with me sometimes too. But the first time when I met him in the OR, he looked at me and was like, what are you doing here? You need to become a mother. Why are you wasting your time being a doctor? Your role is to have children, and that's all that we're good for. And after a good and enlightening debate, mm-hmm. At the end, I was able to like convince him that no, that women are better than just being a mother. We can do so much more. So just combating these stigmas, these stereotypes about women, like, it's difficult, but we really do see it in this generation, specifically at UCLA, in both PISCO and at AGA. All of these women are so incredibly driven, so intelligent, and without a doubt, you could see all of them achieving incredible things and making a meaningful impact in like both of the communities. So I'm truly so privileged and blessed. Yeah. To be a part of that.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that story, because that's the reality of what, you know, our cultures have told us. And of course, as times change, generations change, these things can evolve, but we still carry that with us. And so you see that very strongly still in our cultures, that there's expectations for what a man should do, a woman should do, and also what a man shouldn't do and a woman shouldn't do. And that can feel limiting, or somebody's trying to limit, and they usually mean well, I'm sure, when they, you know, people tell you those types of things, they think they're helping you, not realizing that they're limiting you in what you're doing and able to do. But I think, you know, you had that debate with him, which is good to keep, you know, informing people, but also all four of you from your actions are showing it, are living that this is a change, that things are changing. I think that's good. It makes even a bigger impact. I don't know, Kimmy, if you had something. You gave me a look. Maybe I misread that.
No, I just resonated with her a lot with a lot of what she said.
sometimes even like I can get into my mind a lot about how I'm gonna accomplish everything I want as a woman, like how I'm gonna become a doctor and then have kids, if I'm able to have kids by the time I finish residency and fellowships and all that. But being at an environment at UCLA made it a lot easier. Like, obviously there were still challenges there, and I did have a lot of those cases of misogyny come at me being at UCLA, but overall, especially with both like all the friends I made, and even on the Armenian side, like being with Sarah and Monica, like both of these girls have helped me get through the pre-med route at UCLA. I think that a really supportive environment is really helpful, and I really want more young girls who are coming to UCLA and other universities to realize that there's those support systems for them.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And that's, yeah, another reason why I think both your organizations are so great and so meaningful, the cultural side of it, but also empowering women and bringing women together to support one another through the challenges of
It's like there's a stereotype sometimes that sororities are just for partying and like going out, but for us, for me at least, like the sorority was just a great way to meet very intelligent women at UCLA, and it's more than just like that having fun kind of side that normally is a stereotype for sororities. It's really actually helped me academically move forward.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah, university experience is tough for everyone. But you mentioned this, like, kind of this, like, having it all kind of the challenge that is often brought up for women of, can you have it all? And one thing I've seen a lot of people share is that it also is a testament to our society not be geared towards people and families and taking care of families, where, and unfortunately, the burden still tends to fall on women much more than men, or the expectations are much more on women than men. And so often women are carrying a burden of caring, or care, a burden of care, where they have to expect to take care of everyone from the older generation to their own kids. And because of that, it can at times limit what they can do, or they're expected to have it all, carry all of that, and on top of that, do everything else. So I think that's also very important, that we have to change as a society to make it that families are prioritized and taking care of families, and resources are there. And you see this in other countries, but United States is very behind when it comes to those kinds of things, which also interferes with, because we still have those old gender roles, even in America, of the expectation is put more on women than men to carry that burden. Yeah.
I feel like one thing that our society like makes us do is like pick and choose. Yeah. Like, oh, either you become such a successful doctor or don't, just like you prioritize family, but like why not both? I think that's something new. Like, why do you have to pick and choose? Why can't you be good at both? And I think that's something that society doesn't realize. They're like, no, you either do this or you do that. You can't do both. And that's something that I feel like people should talk about. Why is it not normal to do both?
Absolutely, yeah. And how do you do that? And definitely you can do both. I do think it's important that we prioritize, as I said, taking care of, let's say, children in a better way, so that there is less of that. But we do see that there's, you know, so much more of an expectation on women to take care of everyone and then do it. So I think that would also help, in my opinion, of making it more reasonable and realistic that we're all sharing those burdens together rather than it disproportionately being put
on women. I want to see like more men out there excited to raise kids.
Yeah.
Like I've been seeing kind of it shift a little bit where the woman's outside of the house and the man's working at home or doing like their at-home job. I want to like, let's be proud of that. I'm kind of tired of it just being like the woman has to stay home and work and take care of the kids. Like, let's split some responsibilities a little bit and be more proud of it. Like, I think men should be happy to be raising families and be proud of it. It shouldn't be kind of a bad look on it, which I feel like can still be seen now and then in 2024.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. It's definitely better, but it's still like very negative. Yeah, if someone says like, oh, I stay at home with the kids, it probably still will get frowned upon by a lot of people and seen in a certain way. And I think a lot of people then will say, oh, now you're trying to make men women and make women men. And I don't think that's at all.
No.
What we need to do is we're just trying to make it just the freedom and flexibility that, yeah, so a woman could become a doctor or a nurse. That doesn't matter, but she should have the choice to do whatever job she wants. A man can work outside of the home or stay at home and be with, you know, the kids, and that should be totally acceptable and accepted, and and really, as you're saying, even encouraged. And you do see it in other countries where things like paternity leave are so common and just a part of the society that the man should be at home for, you know, a certain period of time. And we don't see that here, unfortunately, because again, I mean, we have bad maternity leave on top of that. But in general, that paternity leave is such a rare thing. You're seeing a movement towards that as more people are seeing that should be there, but it's still so, so missing. Monica, I don't know if you had something to add on that.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you said other countries. So last summer, I studied abroad in Spain. So I had to take a few courses about like the Spanish culture. So I actually learned a lot about the differences of Spain and their maternity leaves versus in America, and how women do get way more longer leaves than here. That, like, I know some people here that in order to take maternity leave, even if they want to increase it, they have to use their vacations, and it's like extra 2 days off. Like, it's not even maternity leave. Like, usually, like, it takes a few months to recover. It's not a 2 week thing. So it's very interesting how the U.S. really prioritizes like working nonstop. And it's very interesting how other countries are different.
We had a joke in Farsi, like, Omrikar.
Oh, how have I never heard that before? That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you basically, what is it, work to live? No, live to work. Is that how you say it? Yeah, and that is very true. Yeah, I think that's something that we're really not good about. Definitely more maternity leave, but as I was saying, I think paternity, maybe it's because I like love babies and I'm like, can't wait to stay home with babies, but I think paternity leave is such a missing and would, you know, like you're talking about, Kimia, make the balance. It shows, like, you know, society shows what it values and what it expects based on, you know, what it has. So if you only have maternity leave and no paternity leave, obviously you're saying, okay, that's what the woman is supposed to do and the man isn't supposed to be there, rather than making it where everyone, you know, both you know, should be there and helping the kids. And I think that's really important.
No, definitely. And shout out, I know my parents are hearing that right now, but they did that when I was growing up, so shout out to them.
Okay, thank you, Kima's parents, and your hard work has paid off. I'm sure you're very proud of her, and I'm sure all the rest of you, your parents, are very proud of you and all that you do with your academic side, but also as just human beings and doing, you know, what you do with this organization. And again, we can maybe wrap up talking a bit about this event again, that I hope anyone is in the LA area. Of course, if you're a UCLA student, it's going to be free for you, so show up next Thursday, April 18th at 5 p.m. The details, you can find them on, I'll be posting it very soon, but on both of their social media pages as well. What are your socials, just so people know how to find you on?
For AGA, it's just UCLA _AGA. So if you just go on our Instagram, the flyer is there. And also, if you want to come and you're not a student, it's just $8, and the Venmo is AGA-UCLA.
Okay, wonderful. And Sigma Pi, Sigma Psi, is that the handle on Instagram?
Yes, that is our Instagram username. And once again, all the information can be found on both of our Instagram pages. We have a list of all of our amazing speakers, such as Dr. Holoqui himself. So please come. This is such an important event for all of us to attend, and it would mean so much to us to see you guys there.
Yeah, and I hope to see a lot of you out there too, whoever can make it out. I think it'll be a really nice event, and I think it's so great of you to be planning this, and I hope you'll do more events like this. So maybe this will be, I think it's the first one you're doing. Yeah, first one you're doing
first
as a collaboration.
Of many.
First of many.
Hannah's the young one here, so she'll be carrying the torch for us.
Hopefully it'll become like a
yearly
couple times.
Tradition.
Yeah, I would just say a couple times a year, but okay, fine. At least once a year. But doing these types of events, because, you know, it's like anything that we, you know, if we don't talk about it, then it gets kind of put out of the conversation or not talked about as much, including the movements that you were talking about as well. So, and I know that when I spoke with first was Kimia Sarah, that you said it's going to be about both. It's about mental health, but also about what's going on in our countries and in our communities.
Exactly.
And not forgetting
activism
and not forgetting those who are suffering and still, you know, they, maybe we don't talk about them every day, but we should, and we don't want to forget about them. So that's also a big part of the event as well.
Yeah, it's definitely our obligations, especially that we are American. We're so privileged.
Yes.
We have freedom of speech, and we could really, really talk about these freely without the fear of anyone.
And our families getting hurt.
Exactly. Yeah. So we are, like, taking initiative, and we do want to make a meaningful change.
Beautiful. I don't know if you had anything else to add. I saw you nothing on...
No, yeah. I'm just, like, really happy Sarah and I were able to get this going together. Yeah. It was something, like, we always wanted something on the back of our mind, like, to do something together, mm-hmm. and we knew that mental health is a topic that all communities can get together and relate to and come together and talk about. So we're really excited for having people showing up, and thank you for coming again.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's an honor.
It's an honor for me to be at the event next week. I'm really, really looking forward to it. So I'm very honored to be invited and to be there with the other speakers and with all of you and whoever else shows up. And again, I hope if you're listening, you'll also be there. Again, April 18th, 5 p.m. at the UCLA campus. If you want the exact details of the room and where to park and all of that, you can look on the flyer that I'll post shortly, but also you can go to either the Sigma Pi Sigma Psi Instagram page or the Alpha Gamma Alpha Instagram page to see a flyer with more details about it. But again, big thank you to Kimia and Hannah from Sigma Pi Sigma Psi and Sarah and Monica from Alpha Gamma Alpha. Appreciate you all for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you all. Let's go to a commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Again, a big thank you to Kimia and Hannah from Sigma Pi Sigma Psi at UCLA and Sarah and Monica from Alpha Gamma Alpha, also at UCLA, for joining me on the program today to first promote the event next week, Thursday, April 18th at 5 p.m. on the UCLA campus, and also just talk about their organizations, but mental health and mental health in our communities. Really enjoyed the conversation with them. So a big thank you to them for coming on. It's always nice to speak with the younger generation. I'm getting to the point where I think I can say generation. And... you know, be reminded that we're in good hands, that they are going to do better than we have and can you continue to do so. So I really appreciate them coming in and having that conversation with me and to be there with them next week on Thursday. And, you know, we talked about mental health and a motivation for this event being the stigma we have in our community about mental health and seeking out mental health services and how much it makes people suffer. And I've seen that firsthand, of course, as a professional, but even personally and even individually in my own life, seeing that at how we can be so afraid to not be okay or so trying to make sure everyone sees us in a certain way. And so in our culture, we have a huge emphasis on how we come off, how we come across, and we create these unrealistic expectations for what it means to be good and strong that unfortunately make us hurt way more and actually make us hurt one another much more. Because when we don't take care of our mental health or don't feel we have the space to express our emotional struggles and challenges and whatever it is that we're going through, we suffer so much more and we can hurt the ones around us because of it. One, because of just how we're suffering, but two, if we don't deal with our own mental health, we take it out on those around us. We just think of an example of someone who's very stressed and because of that more irritable and more snappy with their loved ones. And so other people pay the price. Something I see so much in our culture, I see it everywhere, but especially I see it so strongly in our culture, is how difficult it is for us to accept and tolerate negative moods or someone not being okay. I really enjoyed Night Vision by Mariana Alessandri that I discussed on Monday's show, and how we tend to, a theme in that book is how much we focus on the light metaphor, and the brokenness story of how if you are going through some kind of mood or emotional pain or struggle, you are somehow broken, and how wrong this is, how it's just a part of the human experience, but we see it so much as a negative. But I just see so often individuals who are in pain and then feel that they can't share that pain with others, and it's heartbreaking. Or when I see someone in therapy, very often there's an exploration of how long they've been struggling or suffering before they finally decided to talk to someone. And you see that so often. It's something I always try to keep in mind. You know, I'm starting therapy with a new client and I'm ready to get into things and let's talk about what's going on. But I have to sometimes remember and remind myself, okay, how long has this person been suffering with this? before they thought it was okay to get help, either from themselves or the people around them, making it feel that that would not be okay. And it really is sad. I sometimes think of the analogy of, imagine if you broke your arm, but felt that you had to hide that you broke your arm. So in some ways that would hurt you more than the broken arm itself. You know, if you broke your arm and you were trying to pretend like you were okay, if someone gives you a hug, even though it hurts so much, you have to just try to hold the pain inside and pretend like you're okay. Everything you do, you struggle with this, but you want to hide it because you don't want to be seen as weak. It makes you suffer so much more because of that. And similarly, that's what we do with our mental pain. You know, someone is feeling very depressed or anxious or going through a hard time, and the feeling is, I have to hide it from other people. I have to show them I'm okay. I can't let them see that I'm not okay. And because of that, we tend to then be even more alone and isolated. How often have you had this experience, or how many of us have had the experience of finally sharing your pain with someone, and how good that can feel, but also it at times allows for them to share their pain as well. We all want to act like we're good and okay and we have no problems, but once someone breaks that ice of not being okay, how much easier does it make for others to then also share that they're not okay, and then how much closer does it bring those people to one another? If you think of the people that you are closest to in your life, it's almost always going to be the people that you've actually shared your bad times with or bad feelings with. It's not the people that you've shared good times with. Yeah, that's part of it too, of course. We should share good times with loved ones. But when you think of the people you're going to be closest with, it's when you share the unpleasant parts of your life and your experience with them. You've probably cried with them or to them or together at some point, or you've shared what you've struggled with. Those are the things that bring us together. But unfortunately, what we have in our culture is this tendency to say that you have to always be okay, because you don't want to come off as weak or crazy, or that you can't handle things or you can't handle life, when really life is all about being together and connecting with one another. And life is difficult. Life is not easy. But it could be made less difficult and less hard if we are with one another and be close to one another, if we allow ourselves to connect with each other, to open up and then let someone in, and vice versa. That's how we make life easier to go through. And as Iranians and Armenians also, we have such a strong emphasis on family. And you know, our family is everything, and being close to your family and loving your family. And of course, sometimes we might go a little bit too far with the ways we show our love, but nonetheless, it's a great thing about our cultures is how loving and caring we are with our families. But we limit that love because we don't allow for one another to not be okay, to share what is going on. And what I see so much is, because we have such a hard time with that negative feeling or someone else's negative feeling, we push it away and we don't want to see it. So no, don't show me that you're sad. Be happy for me. I want you to be happy. And so that part of it is good. Of course, we want our loved ones to be happy, but we also want to allow for them to be unhappy if we truly love them, to give them that space. You know, this is something I hear from people, especially parents. Well, I don't want my child to be sad. And of course not. You don't want your child to be sad. But if they are, wouldn't you want to know? Just like if your child was sick and had a cold, would you rather your child tells you they have a cold, or would you rather they try to hide it from you, go in the bathroom and cough so you don't find out, try to act like they have a lot of energy even if they don't have energy, do all the things they usually do even though it's hard for them and might make them worse? Would you rather that, or would you rather say, Mom, I'm sick, Dad, I'm sick, I have a cold, I need to rest, and then you would want to be there for them. You don't want them to be sick, but you want to know when they're sick or when they're not feeling good. I just hope we can extend that to include emotional pain. I don't want my child to be anxious. I don't want my child to be sad. I don't want my child to be feeling hurt or feeling down. But if they are, I want to know. I want to be able to at least be there, even if I can't fix it, to know about it, to be close to them and give whatever love and support I can give. That's all we can do. But because we have a hard time tolerating, we give the message that don't show that. Don't be that way. Don't be sad or hurt. Oh, you're okay. You know, the number of times I've heard parents say, oh, how could my kid be depressed? We have nice things and they have a good room and they have friends and they have all that. How can they be depressed? Whereas depression is not a disease of just not having certain things. And if you have them, you don't get depressed. Depression affects all people from all types of economic, educational, racial, age, whatever it is, it affects all types of people. Whatever it is that you think is a person who can or can't get depressed, it's all people that can be depressed. And often for reasons that we can't quite understand. Even in the mental health field, we try to understand all the mental struggles that people go through, from genetic factors, brain factors, diet, all sorts of different things, but we don't really know exactly what it is to say we can predict depression with any high certainty, predict who will become depressed and who won't and how they will recover and what treatment will work. There's lots of people doing research on these topics, but we're still far away from really getting it. But the truth is we know that people from all types of experiences can become depressed, and often it is that feeling of out of the blue. Sometimes parents think, well, how can my child be depressed? I don't know what happened. And even the child might not know. There often isn't a precipitating event like, oh, you know, this happened, or I'm getting bullied, or I had this very bad experience. It isn't always like that. It isn't always going to be clear in that way. And so we have to be ready to accept that. And as parents, one, I think it's hard to see our children not feeling good, and we have a hard time tolerating that because we have a hard time tolerating our own sad feelings. But the other side of it is sometimes as a parent, you feel like, well, if my child is depressed, that would mean that I'm a bad parent. I'm somehow responsible, or I did something wrong, when that doesn't have to be the case at all. As I said, people can get depressed for all types of reasons that also we don't always fully understand the reasons. And so I've been focusing on depression just as one side of a mental health struggle or type of thing we can go through, but there's a whole range of things that we can experience. And just imagine how much more beautiful life could be if everyone could just share their pain with their loved ones without fear of judgment or fear of them not wanting to hear it. Again, no one wants to hear of a pain of a loved one, but if they are in pain, I think all of us, we would want to know. Wouldn't you want to know if your child was getting bullied or if your child was in physical pain? Would you rather they say, oh, my leg hurts, but I don't want to tell my parents because maybe it'll make them sad? No, you'd want them to tell you. Although you wouldn't like the news, you would want to know the reality, to be there for them, to give them love and give them support. And often we can do a lot. Sometimes we can fix it. Just, you know, someone's feeling a little bit down, they talk to us, they might feel a lot better by the end of it. But sometimes we can't fix it. You know, your child is feeling very anxious or very depressed or dealing with some serious type of issue that they're going through, and we have to be ready to tolerate them not being okay for some time. You know, sometimes a parent will send their child to therapy and then think, okay, well, there's been three sessions, four sessions, shouldn't they be better by now? And, you know, there's lots of reasons why they might feel that way or bring that up, but we often are expecting someone to just get better so quickly, and sometimes that doesn't happen. Some things do get better completely. Some things never fully go away, and we learn how to live with it better or deal with it. There isn't always going to be a cure that makes everything go away. But again, I would just hope our desire would be to know the pain of the people we care about. And so one way we could do that is making it more okay to not be okay, and also make it more okay to be human, because to be human is to have mental health challenges, just like we have health challenges. It's part of being a living being. We are going to have things that don't quite work right in our brains and our bodies and our just whole being. That's always going to be something we go through, different levels of pain, different levels of challenges and experiences. But one of my aims from the beginning of starting the show was to encourage people to see mental illness like medical illness, or emotional pain like physical pain, to not make them so different or think that emotional pain is something you can avoid and physical pain is a part of life. Emotional pain is a part of any life, and especially a life that's well lived, but just any human experience and existence is going to have pain. So would you want to know if your loved one is sad? I would hope so, not because you want them to be sad, but because you love them and care for them and want to be there for them if you can. So I'm really appreciative of all of the students that were here, the four of them that joined me today, Hannah, Kimia, Monica, and Sarah from their organizations, and to be a part of this event next week to promote mental health awareness and to talk about mental health, because the more we talk about these things, the more it could be comfortable to talk about these things. So looking forward to being there next week and hope to see you there also. Let's go to a commercial break. Studio number 310-441-0555. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Today the theme has been on mental health awareness, and also as we had the students here from UCLA talking about how they are promoting mental health with this event next week, but also the events happening in Iran and Armenia and the people who have struggled and suffered as a result. And if I get a chance on next week, I want to talk about this theme of our responsibility. I think a few of them shared about how we are fortunate in the United States. We can talk freely. We have freedom of speech. We don't have to worry about the government either hurting us or loved ones if we say something or speak out. And so it's important for us to use that voice, especially to be the voice for those who often don't have a voice or their voices don't get amplified or don't get heard as easily. And for me, this theme of doing what we can, doing what is our responsibility, is really critical. And what I always encourage, and really it came to me more when I was seeing what was happening after the killing of Mahsa Amini and the Woman Life Freedom Movement in Iran, that it takes a toll, of course, to care and to be involved. As always, I try to emphasize that when we talk about those of us outside of Iran, and that it can be painful to see what's happening there and take a toll on us, it's important to note that that is nothing compared to those who are actually in Iran and have to suffer firsthand. We feel very connected, but really it's a secondhand type of suffering that most of us will be going through outside of Iran. So we can never compare that pain. And so I want to be mindful of that when I emphasize how difficult it is for those of us outside of Iran going, you know, seeing this and being involved in all those ways. Of course, it's nothing like and can't be compared to. That's a very different thing. And I can't speak to or speak for those who are in Iran and what they go through. But this is to those of us outside of Iran who are trying to understand how to deal with what's happening, how to be part of a positive change rather than getting dissuaded or losing hope or losing our motivation to continue. So what I think is important is to focus on our responsibility as individuals, rather than focusing on results, which can sound almost paradoxical or can sound like, well, isn't it about results or shouldn't we care about results? And of course, we should care about results. Of course, that's the reason why we do it. And we also should be aware of or pay attention to results in the sense that it's important to put effort and energy in a certain direction. We want to make sure it's going in the right direction or in the right way, so things can be done better, improved upon. So it's not that we ignore results completely, but when we want to be, or we are part of a bigger type of change we want to see in the world, we have to be ready and expect that it's going to take a long time. Any kind of significant change, especially any kind of change that is related to something that's deep rooted, whether that's a regime or that's a societal norm or law, usually takes a long time to change. And so we have to accept that it's going to take a long time to change, which is why if we focus only on results, we likely will get discouraged more quickly. So if we see something is not right in the world and we say, I want to do something about it, I want to help, and then we do a lot of things, we, you know, even, you know, form coalitions and work with other people, we march on the streets, we post things, we do whatever it is that we are capable of doing, and then after a few weeks or a few months, we don't see change happens, if we are being motivated by results only, or if that's what drives us, we likely will run out of gas because we'll feel like, well, nothing has changed. I've put in this effort. I still see the same pain and suffering, and that hurts me, and it might make us want to give up or make it more likely we give up. And that's why my encouragement is to focus on your responsibility, all of us, my responsibility, each and every one of us. What is my responsibility in all our roles, but specifically if we're talking about the suffering of others and a specific issue? What is it that I can do and is my responsibility? And let me focus on that. Let me focus on asking myself whether did things change? More think about what did I do and what more could I have done? And do I feel good? Whether change happens or not, looking at my own contribution, did I do everything I think I should have done? Can I have no regrets about this? That when I look back, will I not have regrets? Of course, we want change, but we also can think, what if things changed and I could have done more? Maybe change would have happened sooner. Maybe change would have led to less people suffering, or would have happened in a different way. So I'm always encouraging people to look at their own responsibility. What's my duty here? And am I doing it to the fullest? Which is what we want to do in all parts of our life. You're a parent, of course, you notice how your kids are doing and the results of your parenting. But focus even more on what is my responsibility as a parent? What more can I do to be better as a parent? What more can I do to reflect on what I'm doing, even seeking help, talking to professionals, talking to other people, other parents, to make sure I'm doing everything I can as part of my responsibility, my role in this. And so when I think we're looking at social issues, it's so key to have that type of mindset, responsibility rather than results. Another important aspect of continuing to help or continuing to be part of a movement that's bigger and longer term is that we have to be able to tolerate not feeling good. And so, you know, we talk about burnout and self-care and all these things, which are definitely related to this topic. But what we have to be ready and have to anticipate is that we have to be willing to feel bad and to keep feeling bad in order to stay engaged and stay involved. Because something I've discussed on the show before, when we see some type of injustice, you see someone suffering, when we talk about compassion, one way of interpreting compassion or describing compassion is I see someone suffering and through my empathy, I feel bad internally. That empathy is how we can really feel bad for someone else, especially when we more emotionally get invested, not just cognitively. So cognitively I can get, oh, you know, someone is thirsty, that's not good. But I might see a picture or allow myself or video of someone who's suffering and allow myself to feel it more, and I really will feel more deeply this pain within me, which is an empathy part that is connected to that individual. They're human, I'm human. Their pain is something I can imagine because I felt pain. I don't know exactly what they're going through, but I can imagine what that's like. That doesn't feel good. I don't like this. And so the easiest way to resolve this, well, maybe the easiest is to ignore it completely, but if I'm still there for even a little bit, staying engaged at some level, the easiest way to resolve this is to take away their pain. So I just said, they're thirsty, let's say in the example I was using. Okay, great, I can take this person some water. They drink some water. I see the relief in their eyes and their body, and they even might say something to me. They're relieved. That pain goes away. My pain goes away too. That's this kind of compassion loop. Unfortunately, when we're talking about big problems in the world and bigger issues, there isn't this quick type of fix where I can do something and I do it quickly and the problem goes away quickly, now I feel good. So that's why we have to be ready and willing to tolerate feeling bad and to continue to feel bad about the issue and to sit with that pain. Because if we don't want to sit with that pain or can't tolerate sitting with that pain, we're more quickly going to turn away. And that's what happens. Like, okay, these people are suffering. I don't think that's right. Let me do something about it. I try a little bit and the suffering continues. It still makes me feel bad. And to get out of feeling bad, I might get out of the situation completely, meaning I'll check out or disengage or not involve myself in helping anymore because the helping hasn't changed my feeling. And so when we are feeling bad about the suffering that we see and the injustices that we see, it makes us feel bad. And there are two ways we can think of what we can do. One is I can take away my bad feeling by some kind of mental gymnastics of why this is okay, or why maybe it should be this way, or why, you know, everything is hopeless, so who cares? Something that takes away that feeling inside of me by figuring out a way to see it a different way, to change my perspective. That's one way I can stop myself from feeling bad. The other way I can stop myself from feeling bad is to try to change the situation that's creating the injustice. So this is part of the result side of things, where I'm trying to change what's happening. But if I can focus on, I just want to be part of the change, which means I have to sit with things still not being good for at least some period of time, and I have to sit with myself not feeling good about this, then I can move forward. And I think most of us would think that's the better way to live and to act, is that when something is not right, we continue helping in whatever way we can, just because that's the right thing to do. That is our responsibility. It might not change at all. It might not change ever. It might not change at least even overnight, let's say, in a short amount of time. But I'm going to do whatever I can to make things right. And so, to me, a good human being is someone who actually gets saddened by the world at times, or often will look at what's going on in the world and doesn't feel good about it. I mentioned this, I think, on Monday, sure, I don't know if it was last week, but there's often the sense that if someone, two people see a situation and one person feels happy about it or okay about it, that person is healthier, because happiness is healthier than not being happy. But if something is unjust, if someone is suffering, it would be unhealthy to not be affected by it. That to me is the less healthy emotional person, is one that still feels good after that negative thing. But I think this is such a bias we see, even to see it in psychological research, that, oh, well, after 6 weeks, these people felt better than these people. That's better. I don't think of it that way. I think it's much more complicated than that. Okay, after a breakup, these people felt better after 2 weeks than these people. I'm not sure it's because they're healing in a healthy way. It could be lots of other things that are leading to them feeling okay that might not actually be good. So when we are looking at the world, if we see something that is sad, that is not just, we should be okay being sad, or it should be actually even better to be sad, in my opinion. What you often see is people think, oh, they tell someone, oh, why are you so sad about this? Why are you still getting upset about this? And with this air of superiority that, oh, I'm not upset by it, so I'm doing better than you. I'm not upset by it. You're doing something wrong. I'm doing something right. Let me enlighten you about how you shouldn't be upset about this. And I've seen these types of conversations hundreds of times. Oh, why are you worried about this? Or look at you getting so stressed out or hurt about other people who are suffering. But I don't think that's the healthier way to look at the suffering that happens in the world. To be okay about it isn't okay, or isn't healthy. To be hurt by it is actually a healthy thing. So to be a part of movements, be part of fighting for injustice or fighting for the suffering of anyone, whether it's yourself or others, we have to be willing to sit with these bad feelings and negative feelings that will inevitably come up when we see that people are suffering and not doing well. And so the students that joined me today were talking about taking care of your mental health to take care of other things. And that's another part of just taking care of your mental health, to take care of other people and be there for other people. A very cliche, but I think fitting metaphor for this is when you go on a plane and they say, if the air masks drop, first put it on yourself before you even put it on your child. Because if you are not okay, you can't take care of your child. And probably, I'm sure that's said for many reasons, but a big part of it is that instinctively, I think most parents would go to take care of their child first. Let me make sure they can breathe, make sure they're okay. We put their well-being over our own. That is almost part of what a parent experiences, just starting to be a parent, is you're putting the well-being of this other helpless child, helpless being, over your own. But they know that that could be the gut reaction, the knee-jerk reaction is to go take care of the kid first. But they know that, yeah, if you pass out Now the child is not able to take care of themselves. They can't take care of you or them, and now we're in trouble. So we have to take care of ourselves first and make sure we're okay. And finding that balance is difficult. And I'm talking about not feeling good, or, you know, being seeing the media or seeing the news and it doesn't make you feel good, but that we shouldn't turn away from it. That also doesn't mean that you should watch 20 hours of the news every day of heartbreaking images, because you won't be able to handle that. And so I think finding that balance was something that many people struggled with at the beginning of the movement, and maybe now we've gone too much in the other end where we don't pay enough attention to it, we're not looking enough. But we do have to find a balance of making sure we are okay so we can move forward. Going back to the sense of responsibility, how do I make sure I'm okay enough to continue for a long period of time? That's also part of our responsibility. Just like a parent has to make sure they take care of their physical and mental health in order to be the best parent that they can be, as citizens, we also have that responsibility as well. But let's go into our last commercial break. We'll probably continue on some of these themes after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. So today I was joined by students from UCLA who are planning an event that I'll be speaking at next week, along with some other wonderful speakers related to mental health and mental health awareness. And to conclude the show, I just wanted to talk a bit about going to therapy, seeking out mental health services, because I think it's such a misunderstood experience that people, understandably, because you don't know what it's about, might have misconceptions about. You know, therapy is in a way secretive, in the sense that the therapeutic relationship remains a secret, or what's talked about in therapy is a secret or remains confidential. But I think it's also a sense that what therapy is about is often misunderstood, or people have these misconceptions. So to begin with, one of the misconceptions I see related to therapy is that you only go to therapy if you have a bad problem, or, you know, sometimes in the more stigmatized ways, if you're crazy or weak, or, you know, other judgmental words. But there has to be some big problem, because that is a common response to that people give if they haven't been to therapy. Like, oh, I never really had a big issue, so I never went. And it's true both that if you have a serious mental health problem, you're more likely to go, although most people still don't ever have mental health services, even if they have serious mental health issues. So it is more likely that you would go if you had more serious mental health issues. But it also is a way that we misunderstand what therapy can be all about and how it can help us. So that's a big misconception I see. So you don't have to have had a serious mental health illness or issue to go to therapy. Not only that, you don't need to have big problems in your relationship to go to couples therapy. That's another related one. From an individual level, we have it, but also at a couple level. Even when you talk about premarital counseling, which I think is a really helpful thing to go through some sessions of therapy before you get married. Often people's response is, if you already need therapy before you even get married, then you're really in trouble. The marriage isn't, you know, going, is already in hot water if that's what's happening, or must be really messed up. And that's not at all the case. When we talk about premarital counseling, it's not because the relationship is already falling apart or in such a bad place. That also, by the way, shows how we think of things like therapy in general, that you have to wait till things are falling apart to go to couples therapy, or individually, you know, you feel like you're falling apart. Couples therapy, premarital counseling can be very much about strengthening the relationship. So you're actually trying to prevent it from going down a bad path. Just like if you take care of your physical health, you know, you don't go to the gym and think, oh, all these people must really have some bad physical illnesses, medical problems going on. You think, no, they're trying to strengthen their bodies, promote their health, feel good, feel better. That's why they're here. Similarly, I wish there was that type of mindset about therapy and getting that type of support, that it's not just if you're sick or broken, we think, that you should go. It's for everyone. So in premarital counseling, you do a few things. One is you learn some tools and figure out some things, or educated or helped by the therapist to learn some things about relationships and what to expect and some things in communication to improve your communication, learn more about yourselves and, you know, attachment styles, and, you know, people can do different approaches in how they do premarital counseling, but it's more about understanding yourselves better, which I may add is a big goal and theme of individual therapy as well. It's less about fixing problems, or I have this issue, I have to go in for that specific issue. It's more about self-awareness and understanding yourself better. What do I do in relationships? Oh, it actually turns out I'm more anxious than I realize. I just thought I thought a lot, but now I can see that thinking is actually more of anxious. The anxiety is driving that type of thinking, or whatever else it might be. We see that there are we understand ourselves better. So the couple can understand their relationship much better. Oh yeah, this is like, we kind of argue about this, or maybe it's because of my own parents' relationship that I do that, or whatever it might be. Bringing those things into awareness and understanding can be really helpful to the relationship. And also it can serve as a type of assessment. Let's look at the issues we do have and how major they are, how significant they are, and can we start working on them? Because we know that whatever problems you have at the beginning of the relationship or at any part of the relationship, they won't just disappear on their own. They will likely only get worse the closer you get. And if you get married and then have kids or go through life together, those problems will just get worse. So the thought that they'll go away so we don't have to think about them is really a mistaken way and dangerous way to approach your relationship. So with the therapist and talking things out, you can look at what are the problems we have, get a type of assessment on how big they are and what can we do about them. And so going back to this notion that, oh, a relationship is really not doing well if two people are getting therapy before they even get married, I think just like as an individual, if you don't think you have any issues, that's actually not a sign of health. That's a sign of lack of awareness. If you also think your relationship is perfect and nothing's wrong with it and nothing can go wrong with it, that's also very unhealthy. Every relationship has issues, just like every individual has issues. It's important to actually know them, be aware of them, and to work on them rather than to be in denial or be oblivious to them. If two people tell me they're in a relationship and they have no issues, I would be more concerned than actually see it as a sign of health. There should be things that they are aware of. What are the issues that you have? What are the things you tend to fight about? Even in a sense, you might be able to guess, if our relationship goes bad, what are the things that might lead to it not going well? We can't predict everything, and things happen that are unforeseen, but it would make sense to have some idea of this is the challenge you have. We keep rubbing up against each other in this way, or we keep butting heads about this issue, or you're more this way, I'm more that way, and sometimes we seem to miss each other because of that. And actually, the awareness of these things can make it less likely to hurt your relationship, rather than the thought that, oh, if I have, you know, we have no issues, that's a healthy relationship. You know, it's kind of related to this theme that it's not if you fight, it's how you fight. Because in any healthy relationship, you will need to have disagreements and arguments. That has to exist if you're both being open and honest with each other. But it's about what you do when those things come up. How do you express those things to one another? And then how do you address those things and work through them with each other? Unfortunately, in many relationships, that just doesn't happen. The working through is not there at all. They might not even be addressed or brought up. Or if they are, it's just brought up and then, you know, left to simmer. So often I see it in families and couples, you know, they share stories and it's like something happens, some really bad moment comes up, and then it's just forgotten about and ignored because it feels too uncomfortable to face it again or to really get into it. Or we might feel too uncomfortable about how we brought it up, and now we just want to avoid it and we wish it just never happened. But that doesn't go away. The issue is still there. Now what has happened is still there and won't go away and needs to be dealt with. So that's a big misconception, is this idea that you go if you have big problems and the goal is to just fix problems. The awareness piece is a much bigger part of it than people realize. And as I was saying, no relationship is without issues, no individual is without issues. If you don't think you have any mental health issues at all, if you think you're perfectly sound from a mental health perspective, that means you're probably causing a lot of mental health problems for people around you, meaning that your lack of awareness of whatever your issues are probably hurting the people around you a lot. And you just might not be aware of it, whether they don't tell you, or you might be in denial of that too. They tell you, and then, oh, you're still the problem. So to me, a mentally healthy person knows their mental health problems and mental health weaknesses or what they go through. It's kind of like an athlete. If you're a soccer player, a very good soccer player knows what they're good at and what they're not good at. They don't think, oh, I'm perfect at everything. I can't be any better than I am. One, they know what their weaknesses are so they can work on them and continue to get better in those areas. But two, when they're playing, they have to be aware of what they're good at and not good at. Okay, I'm not very fast, so I'm not going to try to be in a foot race with a player to go get the ball. I might approach it differently. Or I'm not good at, you know, kicking with my right foot, so I'm going to make this pass with my left foot. Or I might not be able to even make the pass. I'll do something else because the ball's on my right foot. So knowing your own strengths and weaknesses is helpful to be a good soccer player in this analogy. But even just being a good person and a good person in a relationship, you have to be aware of your strengths, but also your weaknesses and what are the areas that you need to improve or what can be difficult for someone else who is in a relationship with you. You should be able to answer the question, what is it that can make it difficult to be in a romantic relationship with you? What are the things about you that can make it difficult for someone else to be in a romantic relationship with you? Now, of course, there are some things that are personal that for some person, you being more loud, they actually might like it and someone else might hate it. So there are definitely these personal things and idiosyncrasies, and that's why we want to be with someone where as much as possible there's alignment with how we are and who we are and that they like those things. But even still, with whoever with, there's going to be things about us that they don't like. And so you should be able to answer, what is it about you that might make it hard to be in a relationship with you? And if you're listening right now and you say nothing, that's actually not good at all. And again, that probably is part of your what makes it hard to be in a relationship with you is that you are defensive or in denial and not aware of yourself at all. And that itself is another one of the things that probably will make it hard to be in a relationship with you. So you should be able to know, sometimes I'm a jealous person. I've realized I could communicate a little bit too harshly at times, and that could be tough. I say things in a certain way. Or I'm not a great listener. Sometimes I zone out too much. And again, it should probably be more than one thing, but hopefully you can think of one thing, but a few things that would make it difficult to be in a relationship with you. What is it about you? I really hope you do think about that a little bit. And again, the strength isn't to say nothing. I've worked on all of it, and now I'm so good to be in a relationship with. That to me is someone who's totally missing themselves and missing the point of seeing who they are and having the genuine humility to see themselves for what they are. And the book I read about humility, I think it was last year, I loved the definition, because often when we think of humility, like so many human characteristics, it's this characterized or this caricature version of it where it's like, oh, being humble means you, oh, I'm so bad, I'm not good, oh, I don't think I'm good at anything, don't tell me I'm good at anything, I'm bad at things, is the way we tend to think of humility. But that's not genuine humility. In the book, I don't remember the author's name, apologies on that, but the definition was that humility means seeing yourself the right size. So not thinking you're less than and not thinking you're better than you are, but really seeing yourself for what you are. And so to have genuine humility, you have to actually have good self-awareness to understand yourself. These are my strengths and weaknesses. This is something I'm good at. This is something I'm not so good at, because you can't see yourself the right size unless you can really see yourself. So we have to have that genuine humility to understand. And also, it's good to know your strengths. This is actually things I think are good about me as a partner. If I'm in a relationship, I do this and this and the other thing, or I think I'm caring in this way, or I'm actually a good listener, unlike the other person here, the example I was giving. And so that can be good to know as well. But to really know ourselves, we have to know the strengths and the weaknesses. And kind of on a side note, this is something that we often forget. We're thinking about how to find the right person. We forget to make ourselves the right person or a better person. How can I improve on myself? So I'm reminded of Eric Fromm in The Art of Loving, how he talks about that most people think that the problem of love is finding the right object or person to love. I'm on these dating sites and I can't find the right person to love and to love me. Well, that's of course very important. You need that. But we sometimes forget how important it is to work on ourselves, to prepare ourselves to be a good person to also love, or how to become a better loving person ourselves. The whole theme of that book, The Art of Loving, is to work on this art of being a loving person, or developing that within ourselves. So when we think of mental health, just like when we think of physical health, no one has perfect physical health and no one has perfect mental health. And just like our physical health will also have these ebbs and flows, oh, you might be feeling sick, you might go through an illness, our mental health will go through those things as well. Some things are more chronic, some things are more acute, some things are more constant, some things might flare up here and there, but we have different aspects of our mental health that have to be addressed and looked at and worked on. Or sometimes we can't necessarily change it, but we can understand ourselves, and just by understanding it and being aware of it, that can at least make it less problematic, less hurtful to us and the people around us. So I really can't emphasize enough how much I wish we allowed it to be more okay to not be okay, to go through emotional pain, mental pain, to struggle with something, both for ourselves and those around us, and those are very interconnected, because if we don't think anyone else should be able to feel that way, we won't let ourselves, and if we don't feel like we should, we won't think anyone else should have that. But these are just aspects of being human. The human being goes through ups and downs, has strengths and weaknesses, has things that it deals with well, things that it doesn't deal with well, has physical pain, and has emotional pain, amongst a bunch of other things that create our human experience. So very happy to be part of the event next week at UCLA to with the other speakers and panelists to discuss mental health awareness, and to continue that discussion and those types of discussions. And so I'm honored from both organizations who have planned this event and invited me. So again, a big thank you to Kimia and Hannah from Sigma Pi Sigma Psi that joined me, along with Sarah and Monica from Alpha Gamma Alpha, both at UCLA, and hope to see you next week, April 11th at 5 p.m. on the UCLA campus for that event. All right, that brings us to the end of today's show. A big thank you to Farhuda here in the studio. You've been listening to In Session with Dr. Fadi Dolakwi. Zan Zendegi Azadi.